Metro Division title. It's on! Line drive right center field. That's number 3,000. What a way to say goodbye.
And now, you're listening to The Strokes.
Everybody, and welcome back to the Stros Bros podcast. I am your host, Richard Perez. Not joining me today is our host, Lee White, but instead I have the Oakland A's superfan and 2012 MLB fan cave dweller, Benjamin Christensen, joining me on the show today. Benjamin, how you doing, my friend?
Doing great. How are you doing, Richard?
I'm doing outstanding, bud. So let's get right into this. Benjamin, tell us a little bit about yourself, and I'm sure everybody wants to know what it was like in the fan cave, but give us a little background story about yourself.
A little background. Let's see. At the end of March, I graduated from the University of Oregon with 2 degrees in journalism, 1 in English. Been a longtime Oakland A's fan since I was about 4 years old. First game I saw was in May of 1987. Mark McGwire hit his 14th home run of the season off Mike Boddicker in what would be his record 49 home run for rookie record season. And just kind of stuck with them ever since. I had a choice between the A's and the Giants. My dad, one of my brothers, was a Giants fan, and my oldest brother, Matt, was an A's fan, so decided to go with the green and gold.
Not a bad decision. You A's fans are some of the coolest people I've met on Twitter, and y'all guys really stick together. I love the A's fans. Definitely like being having the Astros in the division with y'all. What was it like being in the fan cave? I know a lot of people are, you know, really interested in that, myself in particular. Just what was it like being up in New York City with all that?
It was interesting because I grew up in, I mean, like I said, I was born in the Bay Area, so I kind of was already used to a big city atmosphere as a young kid, and then lived in Bakersfield, California for most of my life, so Southern California. And going to New York was really interesting, especially having spent since 2000 in the Pacific Northwest. The one thing that you really need to get used to fast, especially if you're in an area where it's green all the time and sunny / rainy, is that the only time you're ever going to see the sun is if you look directly up, because all the buildings are going to obstruct any kind of horizon line that you're going to see. So that was kind of weird to get used to. As far as the fan cave experience, it was amazing. I will never deny that. Getting to meet players like on a pretty much, you know, every other day basis, having some really cool bands come through. I mean, well, with the exception of like, oh God, what's his face? Adam Lambert was kind of an interesting show to have in a baseball themed environment. But aside from that, all the other shows we had to go through at Avid Brothers, I missed the Counting Crows, unfortunately, but it was fun, and just getting to interact with baseball fans across the country, a couple speckled throughout, you know, Europe and Asia was kind of nice. And then when my time came to an end, all the money that I made, I spent touring around the country, going to every baseball stadium that I could, with the exception of Minnesota, Atlanta, and Colorado. I just kind of ran out of time on those. And I got to meet a lot of the people that I talked to on Twitter and on Facebook, got to take them to the games, and just made a lot more friends throughout the process.
That's really interesting. Growing up in South Texas, you know, really used to big, spacious areas, and New York mm-hmm. seems like it'd be really weird to adjust to that. So it sounds pretty interesting. I know you're featured in the, MLB Network commercial. What's the story behind the tattoos and all that?
So the tattoos was something I've been working on for since I was 24 years old. I'm 30 now. And after I got my first tattoo, which is actually my Irish flag tattoo on my left inside of my forearm, my mom kind of came to me and was just like, you know, I would have thought you'd get an Oakland A's tattoo as your first tattoo. So from that, I took it as a bit of a challenge. And so I started sketching out this really ridiculous MLB kind of montage tattoo, which was originally supposed to be like a full sleeve on my left arm. And it was going to be Stomper, the A's mascot, in this really kind of terrifying, horrific elephant form like running down all the mascots of all the other teams. Well, after, you know, really thinking about that for years and then talking to a lot of artists who said, well, your arms aren't that big, and so we're not going to have enough space to really pull that off. It's like, all right, well, you know, fall back on the drawing board and kind of figure out something new. So for 4 years, I kind of toiled with that. And the moment when it came clear to me was actually I was in the hospital as I had strep throat, a really gnarly sinus infection. My kidneys were shutting down. I mean, I was a wreck. And, you know, just staring at the hospital walls, I mean, you just have nothing to do but, you know, time to think as all these fluids and all these medicines are running through your body. And so it went from being on my arm to, all right, let's see if I can, you know, pull it on the sides of my ribs because I have a lot of space there. And then I stepped away from the whole negative aspect of just, you know, the A's being the dominant force and running all these other teams down and switched it up to something more positive. So decided to do, okay, American League one side, National League on the other. And then for each mascot and logo that I found, I did a lot of research as far as like stories within team histories and had each mascot and logo created to represent each of those stories. So in the case of like the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Parrot, I did it in the sense of the Doc Ellis LSD no-hitter that he threw in 1970. So the eyes of the Parrot are like multicolored. He's got little stars above his head to kind of represent the, you know, him kind of tripping on acid. And then with a few other ones, like I put the Milwaukee Brewers with another former mascot of the Brewers. Her name was Bonnie Brewer. So I have Bernie and Bonnie. But I put them on the American League side because as a kid growing up, they were always in the American League. And even though they switched over to the National League for the 1998 season, I believe it is, it still hasn't flown with me. And then the same goes for the Astros. I still have the Astros on the National League side. But the funny thing about that one is when we went through and did all the outlines of the tattoos and we finished because we started the American League side first. So we did all the outlines on the American League. And then about 3 weeks later, we did all the National League ones. Well, 2 days after we finished the National League outline, that's when they made the announcement they were moving the Astros to the American League. So it's like I was just doomed with that no matter what. But the way I put that one together, I mean, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's Junction Jack wearing like the sunset style Astros jersey of the 1970s, and he has a Colt 45 revolver, you know, revolving around the short time period from what was it 62 to 64 that they were the Houston Colt 45. So it's right. The entire team history in one little mascot, and. And yeah, it was just, to me, it was perfect. And since then, I've added on, I added Orbit like a couple weeks later. And this was before they even made the announcement that, oh yeah, we're bringing Orbit back to be our mascot. And then threw on UP, the Expos mascot. Actually, I did that one January of this year. And I'm still adding stuff to it. It's just a matter of, you know, sketching out more ideas and also getting the money for it because it's not cheap.
Right. good ink isn't cheap, and cheap ink isn't good, is what correct. I've always heard. That's really cool. I was gonna ask about what you had on Junction Jack. That's a really creative idea, with the Colt 45 revolver and the Tequila Sunrise jersey. That's really cool. I do like that. How you paid homage to that. We feel honored to be a part of your body there. The art.
Oh yeah, definitely.
one question from Twitter. I kind of interested because this guy kind of popped into my head, Brian Wilson, his beard. How do you manage to keep your beard so pristine?
Well, I mean, I trimmed it recently, which is like it was really unfortunate that I did it. Oddly enough, it's amazing how many Twitter followers I have that were just so offended by the fact that I cut it down so short. And actually, of all people, the one person who commented the most on it was Josh Reddick, the right fielder for the A's, because we kind of had a little bit of a internal beard growing competition going, and I got kind of tired of it. But as far as when it was, you know, had some good girth to it, I always use conditioning shampoo. I mean, that's a key for any beard because you do have to wash it. And, you know, shampoo to an extent will work, but it'll make it like really frazzy and it'll kind of harden up a little bit. So you have to add some softness to it. And the other thing I noticed is that when I dyed it black, for some reason the luster was just so much more intense. And because if I don't know if you could tell from my Twitter photo, that was when it was I had just dyed it like a few days before, and that's probably the blackest it ever was. But in every photo that I took after that, it was just like, man, this thing is huge. But whenever I looked at it in the mirror, it's just like it didn't really seem that big. But for some reason, photos, everything, you know, it's that whole Hollywood stigma, you know, camera adds 10 pounds, and apparently it added all straight to my beard. So I was okay with that.
Yeah, that's not bad. What, speaking of the beard and Josh Reddick that you bring that up, what did you think about – I'm not too sure who it was, but I was talking to the couple of guys that are out in right field, the bleachers out there. It was Wes and Adam and all them. What did you think about people buying Josh Reddick's beard trimmings?
I thought that was hilarious. What's really interesting about that is when he cut the beard off, it was actually when he was in Tampa. The A's were on the road, and they had just lost the first two of that three-game series. They ended up getting swept, and my girlfriend and I were there for all three games. And Josh, I think, was on like an 0-for-21 slump or something like that. And we went down to the field because our seats were like right behind the dugout. But I always go out for batting practice to kind of analyze to see, okay, who might do well, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he came out and he saw me and he just saw the absolute look of disappointment on my face. And he just said, "It's all on you now." And I just was like, "You've got to be kidding me, man. I cannot believe you did this." Especially considering the fact that he was doing his beard growing competition with Daniel Bryan from WWE, which I guess they're still doing. And I'm surprised how much his beard has come back in such a short period of time. But as far as the clippings are concerned, I didn't even know that he kept them. Because I figured, okay, we're in Tampa. He probably just, you know, swept them into a garbage can. But knowing that they traveled from Tampa all the way to California to be sold at an auction is just so funny and creepy at the same time that there are no words for that. And then when I found out that everybody was kind of like stroking the beard hair for good luck in the right field bleachers, and they went on this ridiculous win streak, it's just like, all right, well, weirder things have happened in baseball, and so I can't really dismiss this because baseball is such a game of superstition and habit that something like that just seems so normal. And if you're not a baseball fan, you just won't get it.
Right. You know, now that they went on that winning streak, it really does make a lot of sense now that because baseball, to outsiders, you know, from the inside looking out, we can't explain it. And from the outside looking in, you really can't understand. You have to be part of it. That's just really cool. I had no idea. I wanted to get further on that, further info on that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, another guy's, Brian Wilson, did you ever get to meet him?
No. A really funny story about that from the Fan Cave days. And I don't know if it's kind of a two-part thing, actually. So Pablo Sandoval and Sergio Romo came to the Fan Cave, and the girl who ended up winning the entire, you know, Fan Cave competition, which, if you want to call it that, I mean, it was so shady in regard to, you know, how people won and people were kept in the Fan Cave that that's kind of why I have some bitterness toward it, because I was the first person kicked out, despite the fact that I was the fan favorite and the media was like really behind me. But so the two of them came in. Ashley Chavez, the Giants fan, was, you know, just all sorts of happy, and we were all very happy for her. And so the sketch that they did with those two was we went to Washington Square Park, which was actually only about 8 blocks away from the Fan Cave, and they set up this little booth so that fans would come up and do like custom handshakes with them. And they saw me and they were both just kind of like, okay, you know, who's this guy? And because I was wearing this bright green Oakland A's shirt and I had this giant black beard, and they both thought that was kind of funny. Well, before we went out, I brought my black hooded sweatshirt with me. and I threw it on, and I threw my hair back, because my hair is really long too, because I grow it out for charity and, you know, donate it once it gets to a certain length. But I didn't wear a hat, and so I just threw my hair up and threw my hood over the top, so it looked like I was, you know, bald, or I had my head shaved, whatever you want to call it. And as soon as they saw me, and as soon as I put my sunglasses on, they're just like, oh my God, it's Brian Wilson. And because I never realized how much I look like him until I started doing that. And it's just, and everybody was just like, yeah, you look spot on. And even before I went to New York, I was walking around, you know, San Francisco and San Luis Obispo, all these little parts, you know, kind of in and near the Bay Area of California, wearing the exact same attire, and everybody stopped me on the street and like, are you Brian Wilson? I'm like, no, I'm not actually, but that's kind of funny that you would say that. So we went out and we filmed this sketch, and so I, you know, have my hair up and et cetera. And there are all these San Francisco Giant fans just kind of milling about, you know, waiting to meet Pablo Sandoval and Sergio Romo. Well, I'm just standing there doing nothing, and people are coming up asking for photos and for my autograph. And then I have to stop them, like, do you know who I am? And they're like, wait, you're not Brian Wilson? I'm like, no, I'm one of the cave dwellers. And they're like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. So as a result of that, the production crew kind of witnessed what was going on, and they set up a sketch that was going to be filmed the next day with just me, in which case it was going to be Barry Zito and me walking around Times Square, and whoever got the most requests for autographs and photos was crowned the winner. And Barry Zito backed out last minute.
Oh, wow, man. That would have been totally cool.
It would have been really good to see, you know, how that one actually would have played out.
Yeah, now I'm really interested in that. I really want to see that. But before we go on any further, we'll take a quick little break here on the Stros Bros podcast. We got Benjamin Christensen here. Keep it locked in here, guys. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
And now we're back on the second half of the Stros Bros podcast. So Benjamin, you mentioned in the previous half that the fan cave was, you know, rather shady, and how you were the first one to be voted out, or however that worked out. I think it's a general consensus. How does one win the fan cave, and how does that work out? You know, for people who want to go into the fan cave, how does that work out? How does that, you know, what was your experience with it?
Well, my experience is it was much different than, like, the first year it was just two guys, and they were there the entire year. This year, it's just, they did the same thing. They did, like, eight or nine people again, but there's no voting system. It's just, you know, people are just randomly kicked off. And so the year that I did it last year, the whole thing was set up based on, you know, fan voting. It's like, if the fans gave you votes, you'd stay in. And we knew, the nine of us knew in advance that, you know, voting counts to a certain degree. But at the end of the day, it's the executive and the marketing team behind it that are really going to be the ones with the final say. So to get into the fan cave in the first place, like, they took 50 of us, and then we had to do we had to get votes. We had to get votes to stick around for the final 30 to go for the final interview. And that consisted of campaigning in any way possible, and then trying to get publicity through newspaper, magazine, television, et cetera, whatever. So when I did it, because I'm, you know, a journalism major, I know the ins and outs of how the media works. So it's like, being the tattooed guy, I knew I could sell it based on shock value. But I first tried to do it just based on, you know, I'm a journalism major, I'm a big sports guy, I'm an Ace fan, whatever. Nobody cared. Nobody cared about that at all. Even in Eugene, where I was going to school, just nobody cared, including the school newspaper. But as soon as I presented the Fox News station with, oh yeah, I'm doing this and I have every team tattooed on my body, then the light went off and everybody, the station came out to my house, they did an interview, saw my massive hat collection, and then ended it with, you know, me showing off my tattoos. Well, that turned into, like within 3 days, I had Yahoo, Deadspin, NBC Sports, and pretty much every major news network calling my house asking for an interview. And so the publicity part was taken care of, and I was, you know, easily getting votes. So go through the top 30, wow the executives, and make the final nine to get to New York. Well, the same principles were applied in New York, and so we still had to get the fan votes. We had to interact with people, and then a lot of it was going to be based on how the executive saw us, like, interacting with everybody else in the fan cave, et cetera. And it was just kind of interesting that so many people, like, of the nine of us, I talked to the most people on Twitter and on Facebook. And because anytime anybody had a question and they would ask me, it's just like, well, of course I'm going to answer. Like, I'm just sitting in this room watching baseball all the time. What else am I going to do? So I wanted to interact with the outside world. I want to interact with, you know, average baseball fans, because that's what I am too. There's really nothing special about me. And there's nothing special or different about, like, why somebody on the outside can't be here as well. So of course I talked to them. And then anytime players came in, I don't know if it was just because the way I looked or if the way I interacted with other people, but every single one of them came over and wanted to talk to me and hang out with me, find out what I thought was interesting, and excuse me. And the bigger thing from that was just, I never talked about baseball with any of these guys. For me, it was about, you know, what CD do you have in your truck right now, your car, whatever, you know, what gets you, what do you guys do after the game? You know, how many beers can you drink in one sitting, kind of thing. Like, I'd ask these really oddball questions. And then occasionally I'd ask, like, a really clairvoyant question, and like something of actual interest, but it had nothing to do with something I was going to share. It was just, you know, I want to know between the two of us. And so I don't know if that was necessarily, you know, if there was jealousy that was coming behind the other eight people there, or if I was making the other eight guys look bad. But by the end of, excuse me, by the end of May, I was done. I had been eliminated. Same with the New York Yankees fan, Eddie Mata. We both got kicked out. And so, I don't know. There was just this really weird cloud of suspicion that went with it. And, like, one thing I can say is that in the last few weeks, I had a bit of a skirmish with the St. Louis Cardinals fan, Kyle Thompson. But that was pretty isolated. I mean, it was we had a heated exchange. And I apologized for everything on my part. And then the next thing I knew is that I was getting taken down to the basement and, you know, being interrogated by three of the executives of Major League Baseball. And it's not a position that, especially for somebody who wants to have a job in baseball, you never want to be in that position. And then, yeah, just the way it was left was just really uncomfortable. No real resolution came from that, because I was still in the fan cave for like another 2.5 weeks after that moment happened. And so I was just never given a reason as far as why they let me go. Which would have been fine. I mean, if they just said, well, you're just not what we're looking for, et cetera, that's fine. But to just eliminate, you know, the most popular person there, the one who's doing the most social interaction with the outside world, and especially the person who got, you know, the name of the fan cave, like, out to the masses, like I did. And plus they put me in that commercial. It's like, how do you just get rid of this without any explanation whatsoever? And that's how it was left. And I still have not received any explanation, and people still ask me this day, it's like, what happened? And it's just a huge question mark.
So really, it's really weird, and I wanted to go to the fan cave, but after hearing that, you know, it kind of changed my opinion about it. But yeah. You know, because that doesn't really seem all like it seems like fun, but it's not all that it's cracked up to be. That's really just a really hard experience, because
Oh, yeah, big time. And I mean, especially considering the fact that, you know, my entire life has been dedicated to this, basically. I mean, not necessarily, you know, fan cavery, but doing the journalism thing, doing the interviewing people and talking with people on the outside and, you know, doing stuff involved with Major League Baseball. And then all of a sudden just comes to a crashing halt and it's like, okay, well, what do I do from now? What do I do from here? And that's been like the most challenging part is just like now trying to find a job. And I've applied to a number of jobs within Major League Baseball and have yet to receive a single response. So with that, it's like, and I have the fan cave on my resume. So it's like, am I being, you know, have I been blacklisted and I'm just not aware of it? Or is it just that, you know, I'm just not getting responses? And the answer can really go either way on that one.
So really, going on to other things, what else has been there? You know, fan cave, and what else is there to about you, Benjamin Christensen?
Very little has changed. I mean, as far as like me and the way I interact with people, like anybody who still wants to talk about baseball, I'll do it. I still get to get out to as many games as I possibly can. I think I've only been to about, how many have I been to this year? I think only like like 12 or 13, a couple in Miami, a couple in Tampa, and then a few down in Oakland. And I'm actually, going to Chicago here in a couple of weeks to go catch Pearl Jam at Wrigley Field and then a White Sox game the next day. So I always try to travel and still keep the baseball experience in mind. And I mean, cause the biggest thing for me is just sharing it with everybody. Not in necessarily like an arrogant way, because there are some people that can do stuff like that, and they'll just try to rub it in other people's faces, like saying, oh yeah, this is what I'm doing, you know, don't you wish you were doing this? And it's like, that's not the route that I want to take. For me, it's, you know, everybody has a dream of doing something, but, you know, in the case of us baseball fans, like a lot of us just, you know, we want to go to all the games, we want to go to all the stadiums, etc. And my whole approach to it is just that, you know, I'm gonna show you what it's like, and I hope this motivates you to take a trip of your own, because I hate seeing people not, you know, get more fulfillment out of life, and that's what I've always tried to do for myself, and so that's why I try to encourage with everybody else.
That's pretty cool, man. I like that real humble approach to it, and it was really cool, you know, getting to talk to you doing this, especially being so really open. I've put out a couple of invites to the podcast to certain other people and never gotten a response, or, you know, they never came through. Yeah. So it's really cool. I appreciate you taking out the time, man.
Oh, anytime. I love talking about baseball. I love helping out, especially fellow journalists. I mean, so I know what that's like. I know what it's like to not get an interview, and especially the time when you get an interview and then you try to get somebody to open up more and they just want to give you these little flat 3-word answers. It's like that's death. And so I try to go above and beyond that.
Yeah. I got thrown, I don't want to say a sink or swim, but, for my university newspaper, a little Texas A&M sister school down in Kingsville, the Astros, there's a, their double-A affiliate, the Corpus Christi Hooks, my hometown. They played an exhibition match, and I got to go cover the game for my newspaper there, and it was really cool actually getting to meet the some of the players there and doing interviews and all that. So I, you know, sort of know how it is and how dealing with the Major League Baseball players, and it's really cool. You know, I got my first snub there.
Who was it?
Wandy Rodriguez. I actually, I asked him for an interview, and he said no, that he didn't speak English. And I was like, well, I mean, this guy, you know, he was dressed in a nice suit and all that. He was sitting on the couch in the clubhouse with his buddies, and he was like, nah, man, I'm not doing that. You know, it's just some college kid. He's like, no, bud, I'll pass on that. And so I was like, oh man, I kind of felt bad, and you know, I kind of felt like the little guy there. But there are some other people there that another guy, Chris Johnson, came over. Now he's playing for the Braves. He says, come here over here, I'll give you an interview. and Chris Johnson gave me an interview, and that was really cool. That was probably the best memory that I have from that night. Just Chris Johnson being a real bro, saying, "Come over here, I'll do you an interview." So that was really cool.
And now he's a candidate for the batting title this year.
Right? It's so cool getting to see him play in Corpus as a minor leaguer, and then getting an interview with him right there. It's really cool. Speaking of, you know, accomplishments or titles, what do you think about the A's getting snubbed? A lot of people got snubbed for the All-Star bid.
I did my best to keep, you know, a diplomatic approach on Twitter about that, but you know, throughout the day, there comes times where you just have to like spout some frustration out, and it was wrong. I mean, it's on so many levels, because this is something that dated back to last year in the Fan Cave, which is funny that it really ties in with it, but it does. One of the little challenges we had to do was create an All-Star campaign video for a player on our team. So I made this really amazing, and I rarely ever pride myself on you know, my work. So, but this one is still one of the best pieces of work I've ever done. It was an All-Star campaign video for Josh Reddick, and it was at a perfect time. Like, he was leading the league in outfield assists. It was right when he caught fire, just cranking home runs left and right. And I had Eric Burns, you know, former Oakland Athletic and current KNBR radio personality / MLB Network analyst. I have him on video endorsing Josh Reddick. I also have Jay Bruce of the Cincinnati Reds doing an actual ballot and voting for Josh Reddick on my video. And then I teamed up with a group of Oakland A's fans in New York, and they helped me put it together. One of the girls was like a former Miss Oakland from like 2007 or 2008. So it's just like all these really weird things kind of came together, but all these really good jokes that I had. And so if you ever get a chance, like I can, you know, send you the link on Twitter or whatever, just watch it and you'll kind of see where I'm getting at. But I lost on that. And then sure enough, Reddick lost on making the All-Star team, which he should have made. It was such a travesty. And now there's this year. Donaldson statistically, I mean, I'd even say, like, as far as if you want to go offense and defense, is probably the best third baseman just this season, not of all time, but just this season in baseball. Offensively, he's number two behind Miguel Cabrera, obviously. So there was no way that he was going to beat him because people love home runs. But Donaldson was number two in the American League offensively, and yet, you know, Manny Machado, I'm not going to take away his great season, you know, got the nod in, and then Donaldson was just left off even as far as an, you know, additional reserve. Well, more importantly on top of that, Jed Lowry, same thing, I think he's actually number one right now. I think he's the best statistical shortstop currently in the American League for sure, and I think he's number two behind Segura of the Brewers offensively for shortstops, and yet he got left off. And most people forget about Lowry. It's just like, well, what's up with him? It's like, no, he's dominating. And then, you know, obviously we have Bartolo Colon getting a bid, but only because Clay Buchholz was hurt. So at the way it was going, nobody on the A's was even going to make the All-Star team if it wasn't for this one guy being on the DL for the last month. But even in which case for that, Bartolo's going to pitch on Sunday and not even make an All-Star game appearance as it is. So, you know, depending on who his replacement's going to be, we may not even have All-Star representation. So it's a complete travesty on, you know, I hate the fans on this one, but they did vote, and so they are partially to blame. So there's the problem with the fans, there's the problem with Jim Leland and the players he chose, and then whatever the formula that MLB uses to, you know, bring all these other reserves in is just completely questionable at this point. So, because the A's keep getting hosed on this year after year. We haven't had a position player on an All-Star team since Ramon Hernandez's catcher in 2003. So, to me, that's a problem, especially when we have guys dominating the way we do.
Exactly. I was going to elaborate. I was surprised that Well, Jed Lowry was sort of injured on and off last year playing for the Astros. He was actually one of my favorites to get to know, to get to see for the Astros play. He was one – I was honestly surprised when I saw he didn't get nominated this year, or he didn't get the bid. Really, and I've been teasing a couple of the guys on Twitter, saying, oh, you know, A's fans are really salty about this and all that. it's really just all in good fun. And I really feel for y'all, because the Astros having one all-star representative, maybe the last four years, maybe? I think 2009 we had Berkman and somebody else go to New York. Or not New York. Was 2009? In
2009. Oh God, where was that?
New Yankee Stadium.
It was.
Was it in Yankee Stadium?
No, 2008. 2009. Was that Anaheim?
No, Anaheim was 2010. I have that cap.
Okay.
2009 was in St. Louis.
That's right.
Okay, so yeah, we had a two or three there, and so we've had one All-Star representative the past 4 years. Michael Bourne in 2010. Hunter Pence, 2011, Jose Altuve last year, and this year we're having Jason Castro. Mind you, it was the coming out parties for these guys that came out and ultimately got traded, Pence and Bourne.
Yeah.
But really, I think I kind of take a look back at what we've got, and I think these guys earned it. And I can't imagine having, you know, somebody like, I don't know, maybe say a no-name guy for our guys, maybe not a no-name, but maybe Bud Norris getting selected and having Altuve or Castro getting the snub. So really, I feel for you guys, and I know I voted a lot. I really did vote a lot for the A's, because the minor league team, I'm practically a season ticket holder there. I go to a lot of games, and I would fill out a ballot every time I go, me and my sister. And I'd vote one Astros and one A's. So really, I did vote a lot, and I'm really surprised about it. So
yeah, I'm perplexed on this. I mean, it's like the thought that I had yesterday, pretty much like right before I went to bed, is, you know, if, let's say the A's theoretically win the World Series this year, I think the biggest screw you that could possibly happen is Bob Melvin, you know, or even if we lose the World Series, because it would mean if we go there, Bob Melvin would be the All-Star manager next year. And the biggest screw you could give is just like, well, I'm taking the entire team. Sorry. Because I looked at Jim Leland's, past, because this is the third, third All-Star game he's managed. He did it in 2007, and then he did it in 98. In 98, he took half of his Marlins team from the 97 World Series. I mean, granted, a lot of the guys were, you know, either in San Francisco or Montreal or playing wherever, but he still took a ton of his guys. And then he did the same thing in 2007. So when he came out, I guess it was today, gave an interview and said, oh, Josh Donaldson's an all-star in my eyes. It's like, really? Well, why is he not on your team? Because I see the lips moving, but I'm not seeing any action taken. And so that kind of stuff really bothers me when they add just a little bit more fuel to the fire.
Right. And it's really perplexing, and I can kind of see maybe not a bias, but you know, he's leaning towards it. And you think that he'd really want to preserve his team, you know, not want to play his guys and all that. But I guess, you know, that's his own prerogative and his own choice, and I guess he wants to put on a show out in New York City for those fans.
Yeah, it's really weird the way all that stuff kind of comes together, but
it happens, man.
It is what it is. I mean, there's going to be blame passed around. There's really no perfect system to putting an all-star team roster together, because you know, whether you have the fans vote, whether MLB chooses, I mean, like if you decide to do it just based on statistics, it's like, all right, that would work to an extent, but in a sense, that would be like the purest form, because, you know, guys like your Jason Castro, who thankfully made the team, because he's having a hell of a year. But a lot of these like no name guys who make it, it's like, well, you know, how else do they become all stars unless fans like really crunch the numbers and look at what all these other guys are doing in these other markets that they wouldn't normally care about? And because, I mean, there are guys that can go their entire life and have, you know, put together like these really amazing resumes and have these amazing seasons, And because they don't make an All-Star game, nobody knows who they are.
Exactly.
And I find that incredibly sad.
You know, going on, elaborating on that point that there's no perfect system, a good friend of ours, you know, the Stros Bros, this guy, I'm not too sure if you've heard of him, but his name is Paul Francis Sullivan. We usually just call him Sully. He has a daily podcast, Sully Baseball. He's a really cool guy, really knows a lot about baseball. And it was about a few weeks ago, he proposed the idea of the All-Star game being moved up to the beginning of the season. This really, you know, that's really trivial to my point here. But what he said, he'd have an automatic lock-in. Like, let's say the AL and NL Cy Young Award winners are automatically in. Rookie of the Year, MVPs, they're automatically in. Gold Glovers, they get a big boost. So really, it's based on accolades from the previous year rather than accolades from half a season. So I think I really agreed with that point that he made, and I think that's might be a little bit of a faulty system, but I think it's a little bit better than the one we have. It certainly rewards the players that did well last year.
I actually – there are a lot of points of that I would totally agree with. I think the defensive – the Gold Gloves is like the only thing I'm a little on the fence about, but at the same time, not really. I mean, I'm one of those few people that puts a lot more – value in Gold Gloves than most people should. But then again, I actually look at the defensive stats as opposed to just like the actual award, because there's still the, I think it was 99 when Rafael Palmeiro won the first base Gold Glove when he was playing for the Orioles. It was either the Orioles or the Rangers, but he only played first base for like 36 games, and yet he still got the Gold Glove. So that's just one little outlier. I gotta throw on that one.
Yeah, I'm not too sure if it was Gold Gloves that he mentioned, but, you know, it's something along those lines that, that you know, awards, basically, award winners deserve an automatic bin.
Silver Sluggers would make sense, though.
Silver Sluggers would make sense, as well as a maybe the Home Run King or the Batting King and, you know, RBI King. Silver Slugger, maybe the Home Run King for the All-Star game or for the Home Run Derby. So really, this guy, I recommend for the listeners, if you haven't already, go check out Sully Baseball, at Sully Baseball on Twitter. Really outstanding guy. He really knows his stuff. And his daily podcast, he puts a lot of work into that. He's gone 250-plus episodes straight since October of last year.
Wow. I thought my hat blog that I do every day was insane. That takes a whole level of dedication, a little bit greater than what I've got going.
Yeah, I admire your hats as a fellow hat collector. I read your hat posts all the time. Sully there, I mean, that's a dedication unparalleled. He's driving to the store, recording a podcast on vacation, recording a podcast. I think he recorded a podcast at Trader Joe's one time. So that just goes to show you a kind of a dedication he's got. I really admire and revere what he does, and I hope maybe one day he gets a job in baseball doing what he loves. So that's really cool. You know, everybody go check that out. So as we wind down this episode, we had an outstanding episode. I want to thank you in advance, you know, just doing this.
Oh yeah.
Is there anything you want to plug or anything you want to say at the last coming down here?
Well, as far as a plug, I mean, I guess there's my hat blog. As you can see, I'm actually really modest about it too, which is the funny part. But I'll plug it. I do a daily hat blog on all the new era caps that I own and collect, and all the stories. So there are a lot of fan cave stories that go in there. A lot of my stories from the road. A lot of stories about people that I've met, and it's also just an appreciation for the game and a lot of players that most people haven't heard of. But it's hats and tats. .blogspot.com. I use hats and tats, pretty much my trademark hashtag on Twitter, and so just felt like a good title.
It rhymes. It certainly goes well together.
I know. I didn't even come up with it. It's like the funny part. One of my buddies that was in the running for the fan cave just like threw it at me one day, and I'm like, yeah, I dig it. how much do you want if it ever goes big? And he's just like, oh, don't worry about it. So I'll wait to, you know, the day when I hear from his lawyer if it actually does get big.
That's always good. One last question. I went to your blog. Yeah. What's the shark? The shark fin?
Oh my god! No, go ahead and finish your question. Sorry.
Yeah, what? I just want to know the story behind that. I'm curious because I went to a baseball game and I thought about doing it from the from the stadium, and I just really couldn't get a good picture there. But I want to know the story behind it.
All right, it's one of the stupidest stories that'll ever be told, I swear. So and its popularity has just gotten ridiculously big, and I don't know why. So before the fan cave, my roommate at the University of Oregon, his name's Jared. He's a huge Aaron Rodgers fan, Packer fan, etc. I was a big Aaron Rodgers fan, and we was playing at Cal, and I don't know if you know about this, but he does the every time they do the captain's photos, there's the Aaron Rodgers photo bombs.
Really? I haven't heard of this.
Okay. Just search it out. Aaron Rodgers photo bombs. It's incredible. Before every game when they do the captain's photos, if he's not a captain, he'll be in the background doing some kind of crazy photo bomb. And it was during week 4 of the 2011 season against the Broncos, he did the shark. And my roommate and I just thought that was the funniest thing ever. So anytime he and I took photos, we would do the shark to one another to try and ruin each other's photos. We're talking like family events too. It was really bad. So when I got to New York, the fan cave, and we were walking around, going to Times Square, Union Square, going to the Ground Zero and stuff like that. I would pop the shark in everybody's photo. And when we all got back, we'd looked at the photos, everybody saw it, and they were like, what are you doing? And I'm just like, oh, that's the shark, and you just got bitten. And it just became this ongoing joke, because I rarely ever took photos of myself, and so whenever I did, one of the other cave dwellers would be in the background doing the shark as well. So then when players started coming in, The other eight, I only did this once. I told Jonathan LaCroix about it at the Brewers, but everybody else, told the other players. It's like, hey, there's this thing we do called the shark, and they try to get the players to do it on the field, like during the game. If they got like a good hit, or if it was a pitcher and they struck somebody out, they'd ask them to do it, and the players started doing it on national TV. So. But it was just all this whole little thing that I started from this stupid, or it's actually Aaron Rodgers' fault first off, and then my roommate and I, started ripping it off, and then the fan cave ripped it off, and it became this giant like pyramid scheme basically, and then the A's were doing it when I was traveling around the country, because a lot of the players follow me on Twitter. And anytime they see me at the games or on the road, they'll do it. That's like the hello they give me. It's become this really weird thing that I never would have, in a million years, would have expected.
That's an outstanding story. I love that. That is the coolest story I've ever heard. I looked up the Aaron Rodgers thing. I can't wait to dive into these photos. They look so delicious.
They're amazing. They get better as like the weeks go by.
Oh man, that is speaking of photo bombs, he doesn't do the shark or anything like that, but there's a guy, Giovanni Meyer here in Corpus, an Astros prospect. He does, sure they have it at, at Stockton games or whatever, but like a little league team goes out on the field and takes the field with the players and all that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, what he does when the little league team takes a photo on the on field, he's always photobombing it, and he's always doing something. He's got always something new, and it's really a daily thing. It's always fun to watch what he's going to do next. So it's going to that. Maybe I'll pass it on to him to do the shark, and we'll see how far that goes in the Texas League.
Do it.
Anything else, man? Big props to props for having Jose and Lucas Harrell on your Astros cap, though.
Oh, dude, I mean. Who else could I have? I would have thrown Travis Blackley's number on there, but I wrote a whole long thing on him, much earlier in the year with the Australia baseball cap, and so Altuve and Harrell were definitely two at the top of my list.
Yeah, interviewing Harrell, he's one of the coolest guys ever. He really is. Nice. All right, man. Well, as just to close this out, I appreciate what you've done here. Appreciate coming on. I love talking this. Definitely want to do this again later on. So I just want to thank you, man, from the bottom of my heart. Appreciate it. Had a hell of a time doing this. Just a big thanks to you, man.
Dude, had a lot of fun. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
I appreciate you coming on, man. So until next time, thank you all for listening. Keep it locked here on the Astros Bros. We'll see you guys next time.